Oh, er pusht it. Gustav Stahl and Torvi Hoskoldsen is on.
You hear me?
Okay.
And it says it's recording. You don't have to record it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll. All right, I think we'll get started. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday weekly webinar, an open forum discussion. I'm Courtney Kobel, Executive Director of NDMA. On behalf of NDMA, I thank you all for attending this webinar and for your membership commitment to North Dakota Medical Association. These webinars have really gotten to a great start, and I really appreciate everyone attending. In COVID news this week, HHS released $30 billion out of the $100 billion allocated under the CARES Act for healthcare. $91 million of that is slated for North Dakota healthcare systems, physicians, and other professionals, and is in direct proportion to your billing for Medicare. More funds will be released to compensate non-Medicare billers. It's important to know that these funds are grants and not loans. We'll be following this issue closely and keep everyone updated. Yesterday, the governor issued his surge plan in order to prepare for any surge above the present hospital capacity. Other issues on our radar this week are liability concerns and payment parity for telemedicine. Finally, note today, Governor Burgum at his press conference extended our closure orders, the business closure order, to April 30th. That concludes my updates, and I'm sure we're ready to learn more from our panelists. Tonight's webinar panelists are Joan Connell, Jeffrey Sather, and Kirby Kruger, all of which are on IC right away, timely appearance. Thank you, guys. Dr. Connell is the field medical officer at the North Dakota Department of Health and leads the Physician Advisory Group on COVID-19. Dr. Sather is the Trinity Health Chief of Staff. He's a board-certified emergency physician and serves as the medical director of Trinity Health Emergency Trauma Center. Kirby Kruger is the North Dakota Department of Health Medical Services Section Chief and Director of Division of Disease Control. After the presentations, we will have the opportunity for questions and open discussion. Please type your question in the question box, and if necessary, you will be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. Thank you. I'll just hand it over to Joan then.
Thanks, Courtney. So this week I have been focusing a lot on the domestic violence, homeless, and food insecure task force with which I'm participating. And there have actually, I've been sitting there passively in these meetings for quite a long time because there's a lot of experts involved who deal with this population and their unique set of needs on a daily basis. So I don't have much to offer. However, one of the things that's going to be happening is we're going to be housing homeless people and domestic violence, people who shelters are filled for in hotels. And so this brings its own set of circumstances and needs for that patient population. So some of these homeless people will have a diagnosis of COVID. Some will be under investigation. Some just simply need housing and they're asymptomatic, haven't been tested. So one of the things that I am advocating for is that these patients who are placed in hotels who automatically have a social human service zone intake and a behavioral health consult for concerns for addiction and substance use also have a consult or a connection with a medical home. Because as we all know, patients need a medical home, and that's what's best, and that has been documented to have best outcomes. Furthermore, at this time where we have a lot of outpatient physicians twiddling their thumbs, I am anticipating that there's a large group of physicians who could potentially provide excellent service to this set of patients. So one of the complications that's come up from that is Medicaid eligibility. And I am learning through participation in the Medicaid, the MMAC group. What is that, Courtney? Courtney's on it with me.
MMAC. I'm not sure. The Medicaid Medical Advisory Committee.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. So you can't, you aren't automatically eligible for Medicaid if you're a homeless person, and you would need to provide financial statements and things like that, which oftentimes exclude this population. However, there is this law, according to Capri Snap, the head of Medicaid, that if you are in a hospital, which I think would count as an emergency room within a hospital, and someone from the hospital works on completing your Medicaid eligibility paperwork, you can be presumed eligible. But that can only happen in the hospital setting. So the patient, the COVID or the person who is homeless and just gets displaced to the hotel without the stop in the hospital may not have access to this. The other concern for this patient population is that there are several hospitals in North Dakota who don't have a person in their hospital system who can do this Medicaid eligibility. And I learned that this morning. So I am trying to reach out to those facilities that I recognize as potential major players in the COVID response and major players for having hotels in the community, in their communities that will be housing this patient population, to encourage them to find somebody who can do this Medicaid eligibility piece. So that's one big thing. The second big thing I've been working on this week is, as you know, as a medical director for special health services, I have a very close, wonderful partnership with Family Voices of North Dakota. And they pretty much since the beginning of COVID coming to North Dakota have expressed concerns about two major things. One is if we had to ration medical equipment such as ventilators, then are there laws in place in our state that would make sure that kids and adults with special needs would not be discriminated against? And the second concern that they have is are those people with special needs going to have the same ability to receive the extra services they need, like one of the examples is 24/7 availability of someone who can communicate with them if they're hearing impaired. So things like that, which are very reasonable and they are regulations in times of normal hospital stays. But in this situation of surge, I think many of these things under our current processes would be impossible. And with all of those things come in our states on the East Coast, there are lawsuits against physicians and physician facilities for making the wrong choice on who gets the ventilator, on not providing 24/7 hearing devices. It is ripping my heart apart from both sides. And I often tell people, I totally agree with these concerns, but if anybody tries to sue my husband, I may murder you. So I really do see it from both sides. So I'm working really hard to try and find some agreeable thing. And actually, we had a big meeting about this today, and I think the avenue we're going to pursue is New York has just come out with their third attempt at rules that regulate people with special needs having being allowed to have people in the hospital room with them. And since this is New York's third draft, this third one is much better than their first two. So we're going to use those, and we're going to probably try and incorporate, yes, you will be allowed in the room, and it will be your responsibility to provide some of these needs to your loved one or your guardian, if you're the guardian, your person that you're responsible for, if the hospital is at an overwhelmed capacity and can't provide the services, is what I'm shooting for, but I'll see. I think there might be other regulations in place on the other side of it that limit what kind of legal action can be taken against physicians and healthcare providers in this time where we're trying to do the best we can under limited circumstances of healthcare personnel, PPE, everything else that we're trying to deal with. So those are the three angles I'm pursuing.
Thanks, Joan.
Sure.
You know, that liability issue, that's something that I've been working on too. So I'll keep you in the loop on that.
Yeah, that'd be great. I think that's really important, because at the end of the day, we are all going to do the very best that we can to provide the best care for patients. And under extreme circumstances, we need to feel good about that and not be hurt by it.
Right. Joan, could you tell the people on this webinar about the rules for nursing homes, admission, or, you know, transferring back and forth? I've gotten some calls and emails about that.
Just briefly. Yeah. Okay. Well, so I will try to do those, but I've been out of the loop for those for a couple of weeks, so I'm a little concerned that I might not get them straight. But is the last time I took a look at those, and Kirby can probably verify. So Kirby, make sure you're listening right now, okay? he does five things at once, always. Anyway, it is my understanding that many of the institutions are asking for a test, a negative test to come back in the from the hospital or to be admitted if you are coming off the street. And as you know, there's nobody in the health department who has ever advocated for testing asymptomatic patients. And I think that's the easy way I remember that, is we don't have enough tests to test asymptomatic people. So the policy that I was involved with is when a person comes into the long-term care facility, they're quarantined for 2 weeks. They get their own room, mask, and if possible, droplet precautions are followed for a 2-week period. And then, you know, their vital signs are monitored. And then if they're cleared after 2 weeks, they can go back into the general population. For the patient who has had COVID, it is my understanding that they need to have a negative test prior to returning to the nursing home. And that was, we devised that because we have seen, you know, this is the vulnerable population everybody's worried about that the entire United States economy has shut down for. So I think it's, when we designed that policy, we did it because we felt like extra safeguards needed to be put in place. Since that happened, providers who are on the ground, boots working, have talked with us extensively about the flaws, especially when you need two negative tests, because that adds hospital days, increases risk for reinfection with COVID, if that's possible, we don't know, or infection from other nosocomial sources. So the last I looked, or we were reevaluating that. Kirby, do you have an update to that?
There you go. There you go. That's how I recollect it too. And we will continue to evaluate these recommendations. They are recommendations, but that's sort of the rationale that we sort of went down as well. And so I think Dr. Connell hit it spot on. So.
All right. Thank you. I noticed, Dr. Shpansky, you have your hand up. I allowed you to talk if you had a question. And you have to unmute yourself.
That was a mistake, sorry.
Okay. That's okay.
Sure.
All right, I will hand it over to Dr. Sather then. Thank you very much, Joan and Kirby.
Hi, thanks, Courtney. I was asked to just kind of give an overview of our response to this whole thing at Trinity Health. And so I'll try to do that in 5 or 10 minutes just to touch on a few things. And so I'm kind of doing this unscripted, so bear with me. I've told many people, just thinking back over my career, some of the things that you think when you enter a career in medicine, that you think if you got to deal with one big event or big thing in your life, that's maybe all you have to do. And as an ER physician, you wonder, okay, what will that be? And having lived in this community for lots of years and been around for a long time, I've told some of our medical staff, I've done a lot of speaking, region-wide and across the country about various things, and it's so easy to get a topic. And I've gone to multiple places and talked about some disaster situations, and it seems living and working in Minot, there's a new one every decade. And so now it's, you know, we're at 2020 and dealing with an unprecedented pandemic. And 2011, we dealt with a flood here where we stood up a separate ER and clinic and mental health clinic across the river over just, you know, a 24-hour period with the help of the state and equipment and our staff just banding together. Prior to that, in 2001, we had the world's largest anhydrous ammonia spill that caused our city to shelter in place. And it was January 18th, 2001, just a few months after, January 18th, 2002. So just a few months after 9/11, 2001. And so people woke up in the morning to an eerie cloud over the city, and you can imagine what was going through their mind and hearing shelter in place. And 87, we had a large chemical warehouse fire. So you just think of all the things that have happened in our community and you've had to deal with, and that's not including things like the DAPL situation that we had, where I was deployed as the medical director for the medical response to that. So it's just amazing when you think of what we're dealing with, and all of us look around us every day and think, how do we deal with this? And it's a new situation. And for us, it's, I forget now, time flies by. It's a whole new normal. You come to work and I'm totally involved in dealing with this COVID pandemic in my position all day, every day, it seems like. And it's about 5 or 6 weeks ago that we stood up our incident command. And I remember well getting the text from one of our physicians that I think was the first positive patient in the state, getting that we'd gotten results from the state lab. And that gave, you know, we'd set up our incident command and we're looking at policies and getting information from the Department of Health. And some policies seemed like they were changing three times a day as new information was coming down. And that first patient made it real. And so we had a first patient, and then we had a first hospitalized patient, and a surprise hospitalized patient. We had a patient that came in, an elderly person that had came in for a fall at a nursing home on a fractured hip, and was seen, treated in the hospital, and then postoperatively developed a low-grade fever. Had no respiratory symptoms. And one of the medical providers, the hospitalist, said, well, let's just test for COVID, even though there were no respiratory symptoms. And actually, the event that caused her to decide to put in that order was she just noticed a family member was coughing. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to test her for COVID. And it came back positive. And then we had to quickly backtrack and look at contacts. And we quarantined, I forget the exact number, right around 50 of our staff because of that event. And luckily, after quarantine, we were already 7 days into that patient's hospitalization when we got the positive test. So we identified close to 160-something potential contacts. And as they went through and risk stratified, we came out with, you know, some no issues. And, you know, maybe someone dropped a tray off at the room, or somebody accessed a chart but hadn't actually touched the patient. That's how we looked at potential contacts, is by looking at the electronic record. And then decided that we needed to quarantine that all of those staff. That included from the ER, OR, up to the floor. And some of those were 7 days in, so the quarantine wasn't as long. And luckily, a few of those actually developed some symptoms and were tested and tested negative. Nobody out of that group tested positive. So we had that experience pretty early on. Early on in this whole pandemic, like I said, we had, I believe, the first patient, and Ward County clicked up with a few patients relatively quickly. And in our region, I remember when we were at 21 hospitalized patients in the state, we had 7 of them in our hospital. So you kind of have that feeling, we have a third of the patients, so what's going on here? But that's quickly dwindled off. In fact, I believe if the patient's not out the door now, they will be in the morning. Our last patient, we will be with no COVID patients in the hospital. So we really plateaued quickly. We have not, I think we are now 9 days since our last admission of a COVID positive patient. And our county and our region clicks up a few patients every day, but not to the degree of some other areas. We've tested around 1,400 patients through our system, plus a lot of others in the region. And we look at the catchment area that we have. I didn't look at today's count, but we were at about 75 patients that were positive in our catchment area here. So there's been a lot of policy change. We've, you know, as everybody has, looked at policies from use of masks how are we saving masks for future and reusing. We've not gotten to the point of reusing. We actually just, we've had multiple versions of masks. We've had versions of door screenings. We actually locked down pretty early on elective things when we had an early patient in the area. We had pretty quick response in deciding we were shutting down, and some people thought maybe even too early. And so our business level has gone down. We're at about 30 to 35% of our normal business in the clinics, and only about 25% in our OR area. So business has gone down greatly, which in a system our size relates to more than $40 million in gross revenue a month. And so it's a big deal. And so we've been watching that closely. We've been having ongoing discussions with our medical staff. And one of the things, looking back on this, it actually amazes me. You know, physicians are a hard group to corral. And for anything, they're a hard group to get on the same page. And I don't hardly remember, we have little over 250 employed medical staff. And then we have a multitude of other credentialed medical staff. And a medical staff meeting, even a general medical staff meeting, if we get 50 of that group in the room at the same time, we're lucky. Something similar on a social event. We started about 4 weeks back now, decided we need to be open and transparent in everything we do. So I started a nightly call with our medical group, and we did it over WebEx, telephone in, and we had on even a slow night, about 150 of that medical staff on the phone call. On busy night, we had up to about 200, so a large percentage consistently and just getting information out. And I think that was really important to our medical staff to keep everybody informed on what's going on, little changes that happened, to get ahead of messages like this patient that popped up positive and we didn't expect it. Something that really impressed me out of that is the way the group has banded together. It was recognized early that maybe we should have a faith piece of that. And so one of our medical staff suggested an ending with a prayer. About 80 to 90% of our staff have stayed on every night for the prayer. And I have medical staff booked out for about 2 months now to do that prayer. And so keeping that faith piece has really been important to the group. Testing, we're testing patients. I think we're one of the first places, I don't know if we were the first, but one of the first to stand up a drive-in process and have been doing that. Actually looked at that process myself very closely today. One of the things that we had looked at about 3 weeks ago was actually moving it out to a more isolated site. We've been doing it in our largest clinic building. It's a multi-specialty building in our medical arts clinic. And there were some of our medical staff voicing that they were a little worried about respiratory patients coming into, acute respiratory patients coming into that area with their more chronic patients. And so we actually are looking now, we've decided we're moving it and have selected an alternate clinic site. We have multiple clinics in towns we're moving it to, or it's gonna be more isolated. We'll have that up and going next week. So that's been a continual thing to look at. And with all the different changes and recommendations for testing that come, we're trying to keep an eye on that. As far as protecting our staff, we have a mask everybody, all employee policy in the clinical areas, which we've had for a long time. We just this week went to mask everybody all the time. So people are, I've got my hand sewn mask. So all of our employees are expected to have a hand sewn mask. A good portion had them already. We had collected, I think, up to about 2,400 hand sewn masks already from the community. So we're giving all of our staff hand sewn masks to wear from their car into the building. And then in the clinical area, they're using the regular surgical masks or N95, depending on what they're doing. And we're looking now to move that to all people coming in the building. We've done anybody that's symptomatic with the door screening, but we're looking to move that to all people coming in, regardless if a patient comes for their visit that they need to see the cardiologist for, or whatever it might be, to mask them coming in. We're doing that cautiously and watching our supply of PPE. I'm sure everybody is. We hear our report out of supply every morning. We did receive the stuff from the state cash and have that, but that's being held in reserve for things totally blow up on us. So we're relying on our supply chain. So we're sitting on surgical masks at about a little less than 2 weeks at current volume. And so in our clinic operations, we're like I said, we're way down. Our normal operation, we see about 1,800 clinic visits a day. We're now seeing 500-ish on a busy day. And so if that goes up, if we're handing everybody a mask coming in, we would deplete our supply quickly. So we're looking now at these hand sewn masks and can the community supply these and how we would get these on everybody coming in the building. So that's how we're handling that. The last thing I just want to touch on, we like many health systems across the country, our CEO made the very difficult decision to look at the sharp decrease in revenue due to the decrease in business. And we've looked hard at staffing and do services to assure the the long-term viability of the organization. We're lucky to be a strong financial organization, but have a lot of things going on, building a whole new hospital campus and all of that, and some dedicated funds there. So we have done furloughs and to some level, about 12% of the workforce. And all of our staff is essential. So it's, you know, you hear the word thrown out once in a while, non-essential staff. All of our staff is essential. And a lot of the furloughs are partial furloughs, where my wife, for example, is a respiratory therapist. Her job is sleep educator. She's cross-training currently to help out should we need ventilator support and all of that. But in the interim, she is doing 3 days training and two days a week she's furloughed. So we have staff in those type of situations. And with our medical staff, there were, I shouldn't say that no mandatory furloughs. We actually, our nurse anesthetists are cut to about half time because of the OR volume. But we have a large portion of our medical staff, of course, is on production, so their salary is down because of this. But we also have staff that are salaried. And it's amazing how the medical staff stood up because we're, myself, for example, I'm sitting across from our CEO and vice presidents who took a 20% salary cut and other people who took a 10% salary cut. So multiple physicians just raised their hand and said, cut my salary 20% if they're on a salary base. So the group, it's amazing how a common enemy and a common threat brings everybody together. So that's the summary of how we've kind of approached as a group getting together and dealing with this situation.
That's very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Sather. I'm curious as to what you're doing as far as masks for the, do they get one for the week or how does that work? For the PPE?
So it depends on the situation and the area you're in. We are fortunate, I think, in some of our supplies. Actually, we have a reasonable supply of things like N95. So we are currently, our staff that are working, we have an actual COVID unit, which is empty now. But there was a point where we had multiple patients. We had a whole wing. So we were using dedicated staff. So that staff wasn't seeing, you know, three or four COVID patients, then going out on the other floor and seeing other patients. So they were using a PPE for the day in the COVID wing. So they were wearing that mask, for example, for the day. Gowns, we use laundered gowns, so we don't throw them away. We use the gowns that go off and get laundered, so we've been fortunate there. We are saving with the state's request to save those masks. We're saving those. We are not reusing them currently. So we're saving them to be cleaned and reused should it be needed. But at this point, we've not had to do that. Surgical mask, it depends on the area. Staff is asked to wear their surgical mask as long as they can for the day. Some staff, as you know, if it gets a little soiled, just wearing one all day, it might get moist just from breathing. So if it gets moist, they're discarding those regular surgical masks and getting a new one. And they, you know, depending on where they work and the person, the volume they're going through is variable. We actually did some tallies, and I don't have that in front of me, but our nursing administrative group look closely at use. We know right down to the staffing level how many masks are used in various units, for example. So that's been watched close, and we've looked close at reuse policies of multiple places. You know, we're in the Mayo network, so information from Mayo and with the recent HON alert from the state, I know our infectious disease group and administrative group over that area. We have a committee that's looking solely at masks with, on with the state and that saving and reuse information that the state is looking at doing. So they're on top of that, and it's part of the strategic plan, but we've not gone to cleaning and reusing in the short term at this point.
Very good. Thank you. Joan, you raised your hand.
Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Sather. That was a really interesting, very motivating presentation, and I haven't heard about other institutions having that same camaraderie and level of fellowship. So I really commend you. And the pay cut is, I mean, I think that's really walking the walk. So I just am really impressed. I have a couple of questions. The one, since you were involved in quarantining several people, I wanted to know what your personal thoughts are about the policy that the CDC just came out with last week, that essential personnel could come to work even if they were living with a person with COVID and just wear a mask. what are you going to do with your healthcare personnel at this point?
So it's mixed emotions on that, right? It's ideally we would not want to do that. And I think luckily we haven't had to do that. We've actually had the situation here. We had a husband and wife, nurse and physician, one of our hospitalists, who were early contractors of COVID from travel. They were on vacation, came home and come down with symptoms shortly after getting back, actually before they came back to work, were tested, both positive. And so you actually, she was tested first and actually got fairly sick. And then he came down with symptoms and tested positive. So you realize close contact is high risk. And then with the asymptomatic carriers of the disease, you worry that do we have someone who now is even higher risk because we know they're close contact, and if they're a close caregiver taking care of patients, what's the risk? And I think in my mind, and we don't have any firm policy, I think, on saying we want people to do that at this point. We've quarantined someone. We have a physician who just got off quarantine not long ago that we quarantined simply because of travel to a high-risk area, come back from a high-risk area. And so we've taken the stand that if they are truly mission-critical personnel, if that physician that came back happened to be a family practice clinic provider. If they had been one of our limited pulmonologists, that might have been a different decision. But I think we have to use a little bit of judgment in how we allow that. The hospitalist that turned positive, for example, he has been 10 days without symptoms. He's been tested three times. All three times he's come back positive. His nurse wife, after her symptoms went away, was tested and was negative. So he actually has gone to their lake house now to get away from her so he doesn't repass it on to their kids and things, and has gotten out of the house. And so I think we got to use common sense. That's my opinion.
Okay, super. And then my other question relates to Governor Burgum's press conference today, where he was talking about reopening for business, and we have plenty of PPE because we've accrued some more. And yet he said we have more cases. This is a record for cases, and who knows if we're really starting to do our peak now. But he did mention elective surgeries in there. And I couldn't understand if he was trying to say maybe we could have some more elective surgeries because our hospital counts are down and we have enough PPE, or if we should continue to hold off on those. So I wanted to know if you or anybody else gleaned anything from that and if it's going to affect your policy.
That's a good comment. I heard that as well. And Interestingly, they were starting while the governor was still talking. We have ongoing, so our medical staff, we have divided into the medical side and surgical side, and leadership groups over that are looking closely at clinic operations and surgical operations. And like I said, we clamped down hard. What I didn't touch on is our process for how we're looking at when do we reopen. And so we have a physician advisory group globally that is multi-specialty, about 20 physicians that we pull together to get information. And then the individual medical side and surgical side groups then look at that in more detail. The leadership group over the surgical side met a couple of days ago, And at 4 o'clock today, they had a conference call with the entirety of our surgical specialty group. So it sounds like the vast majority are on the phone call, and that's what the discussion's around. And it was interesting when this started, we had people all over the board, right? We had physicians that wanted to shut the door and run home, and then we had physicians that don't worry about it, let's just keep working. We all have different levels and different levels of fear and things that bother us. And some of those opinions haven't changed a lot, but we kind of clamped down early on, as I said. So this group has been talking about, okay, what are triggers to open up? And it's been one thing that I've been worried about, and there's been a couple articles out now. There's one I read not long ago that was passed on to me by one of my colleagues about Switzerland, and talked about what happened to some of the patients. We normally see this many MIs. The MIs didn't stop happening because COVID was around. Where did the patients go? And so what's happened in some of those places, what they're finding out happened is the patients still have the MI. They just didn't come and get their cath and their stents. They evolved their MI at home because they didn't come in. So it's actually been a worry of mine for a while. So the groups are talking about triggers to open up, and we're not doing that in a vacuum. Those groups are doing that in conjunction with good knowledge on use of our PPE, good knowledge on what we have available to open up. And we're talking about when we might do that. And we're not gonna do that in the next week, or probably might not even be 2 weeks, but with the knowledge that there is PPE, watching the curve of the patient's rise, I think when we start seeing plateauing, and maybe even before that, if the rise doesn't get steep, we're going to start in the surgical area, for example, outpatient. Our outpatient surgery area is down at our St. Joe's campus. It's our subacute campus, which is part of our expansion plan. We have significant numbers of rooms down there that we will open up if we get a peak of COVID patients. But with outpatient surgery, some of the outpatient same-day type surgeries, those would not be a threat to that, with the exception of PPE. So that group is really talking about how do we use PPE. They're actually talking about how could we reuse PPE, because we're probably using N95 and some of the methods of using the same N95 through the day with a surgical mask over it, for example, for the dirty collection. So they're looking at different methods to do that and looking at triggers. But the physicians are, no administrator is going to tell us when we open up. The physicians are going to make that decision as a group. And again, we've got physicians that are saying, now open the door, let's just start doing business again. And especially when they're seeing their nurse now only working part-time when they were full-time, that's changed some people's opinion. But again, we're not going to move quickly. We're going to move slowly at reopening.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sather. I see that we have three questions. One looks like for Joan, but I'll have Dr. Sather answer the two from Dr. Kumar. The first one is that whether you have in-house testing, and if so, what's the turnaround?
So we have the machinery to do in-house testing. We don't have reagent to do in-house testing. We also, at the beginning of this, we were looking at the BioFire tower, which we didn't have, which has been ordered and I believe is in place now and getting calibrated. But again, we're being told reagent is the issue. So we have the hardware, we have the lab staff in our lab, we don't have reagent to do it. So no, we're not doing it internally. We are relying 100% on the state for our testing at this point.
All right, thank you.
Turnarounds are good, by the way, Kirby. You know, it's been 24 hours or less, and with your broken hardware, it's extended a little bit in the last day or two, but it's been fantastic through the state.
That's good to hear. The other question from Dr. Kumar is if a family member is positive and still at home, what is the policy in Trinity for physician spouse to return to work? I guess that's kind of related to the doctor-nurse couple, but if you'd like to answer that.
So in-house contact, I believe we are still not allowing them to come back unless they're deemed critical need with symptoms. And I think there's been some policy change around that, but I would be guessing if I told you, so I'm not gonna give you a firm answer on that one.
Thank you. And then Joan, do you see that question by Dr. McLean about the states and the FQHC?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Dr. McLean, and I can't believe I didn't think to ask Caprice about that. So I will have to ask her and get back to you. The way she phrased her my general Medicaid enrollment question was only hospitals. So to me, that sounds like maybe IHS, but probably not FQHCs. But since they're federal entities, they might not have to listen to any of the North Dakota rules. And I know this particular rule is tied to the legislature because it had an appropriation. So I'll get back to you.
All right. Thanks, Joan. I don't think we have any other questions at this point, so I'm going to turn it over to Kirby Krueger and make sure that I unmute you, and you can go ahead. Thank you, Kirby.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. Good. So next time, don't put me after Dr. Sather, because that's going to be really tough to follow. I agree. That was a great presentation, and sharing all those experiences, and unfortunately, I've been around long enough to remember a lot of those events that happened up in Minot. So, from my perspective, I want to just give you a little bit of update on what we're doing in disease control and in the laboratory. In disease control, our focus has been on the case investigation and the contact tracing that are associated with those case investigations. The way our system works is that we receive from the laboratories that do the testing, we get electronic laboratory reporting. Those electronic lab reports come in and they feed our disease surveillance system. That disease surveillance system then sends out a notification that to our lead EPIs, and they are able to go in and look at those cases. If it's a COVID-19 cases, it gets assigned out to a case manager, and then that case manager will assign it to interviewers. We have a series of interviewers. At first, we were doing interviews from within disease control. We did that for about a week, and then we had to turn to local public health. Every local public health department in North Dakota has identified interviewers, and they've been trained. And so we have been using local public health interviewers for most of our interviewing at this point in time now. So those interviews get conducted, and then it's about an hour 15-minute process, depending on how complex the situation is. Contacts are identified, and we identify them by name, and we get the locating information, and then the contacts are notified. The cases are isolated, asked to isolate, self-isolate. They're monitored every day. There's a follow-up with them on a daily basis to make sure that their symptoms are improving, or if they have any concerns or anything like that. And if there's concerns, urging them to talk to their healthcare provider if their concerns are such that they need to be doing that. And so the contacts are asked to quarantine. If they're not a household contact, and we have a point where their last contact is known, we have a definite 14-day window that we can quarantine individuals. Those contacts are also followed on a daily basis. They're not actively followed like the cases. If there's an electronic means for them to just text us or email us their symptoms and their temperatures for the day, we can take that. If we don't hear from them, then it's a phone call or a text saying, we haven't heard from you, what's going on? And so that happens until they're done with their quarantine period. For household contacts, their quarantine period starts right away, but it doesn't end until the case in the household is non-infectious. So in some instances, we have had individuals who have been quarantined in their house for a month because the case is in the household, becomes non-infectious a couple weeks after they're diagnosed, or depending on the situation, and then that's when their 14-day countdown begins, is when the case becomes non-infectious. So we've had some individuals that have quarantined for up to a month, they don't enjoy that, and it takes a lot of education to explain, you know, yes, you thought that it would just be a 14-day period, but the 14-day period doesn't start until after your last exposure. And so there's a lot of education that goes along with that. If contacts do become symptomatic, then we try to arrange to get them in for testing. We probably are moving away from that now, because in the last couple weeks, CDC has and the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists have devised some optional case definitions for probable cases. And so if a named close contact becomes symptomatic, we can epilink them and call them a probable case. And with that probable, we're going to go ahead and we're going to go through that whole process again. So we don't actually have to have a laboratory confirmation on those close contacts that develop symptoms. We'll just go run with them as if they have been diagnosed. And we will, if they need, we'll still encourage them to seek healthcare if they need to seek healthcare. And if they want to be tested, that's fine. But it's not necessary for us to do the public health part of it, I guess is what I'm saying. So the other part of this is that our infection control specialists, and we have, I say specialist plural, but really it's one, it's Faye. Faye has been reaching out to all of the different facilities where we have healthcare providers that have been reported, or we have a patient who's been hospitalized, or a long-term care facility. I can tell you, Faye's been working 14-hour days for about 40 days straight. We finally got her some help. If you're not familiar with Jean Rowland was with Quality Health Associates. I think she's retired from them now, but Jean has come on to provide some infection control assistance to Faye. There's a retired infection control nurse in Fargo that is providing some assistance. Although in her retirement, she's choosing to work a 9-to-5 type of thing, but we'll take it. You know, it's hard to find infection control expertise. And so we took it, and I don't blame her. I wish the virus would work 9-to-5, but it doesn't. We provide the technical assistance, and I think the hospitals, for the most part, have a pretty good grasp of what they're doing. And what we're finding is that hospitals have policies, and regardless of our recommendation, you know, the hospitals are following policy. I think for the most part, they take our recommendations into consideration, but there may be other driving factors that lead them to go down a different path with how they proceed. And we understand that. Not that we agree always, but we understand. So, the other part of it is, I think the long-term care facilities actually appreciate that reach out. And so we do a couple different things with the long-term care facilities. Faye does an initial reach out. Our Jean does an initial reach out to the long-term care facility. They do go through an assessment and sort of get the background information. And then there's a strike team that follows up a couple hours later. And that includes somebody with an infection prevention background, and then a surveyor that's familiar with the facility, that's been into the facility, and then another surveyor that has some infection prevention background, and the strike team will go through and provide further recommendations, make sure they have the PPE, try to do some troubleshooting and gap analysis on things that the long-term care facility may need. And our experience has been these long-term care facilities have really worked hard to prepare for this. And when they do get a case in their facility, most of them have been really, really good in terms of doing the right things to try to minimize the risk to the rest of their population. So that's sort of the summary for disease control. Our focus will continue to be contact tracing and case investigation. We have the local public health nurses that have identified, or the local health public health departments that have identified people to help us with that. We have UND and NDSU graduate students in public health that are helping with that as well. And then we have some individuals from the Medical Reserve Corps that have been identified that are interested in helping us with some of that. We do have some clinical nurses that have are available to us. Today we started the process of training some of those. These were individuals that work in a outpatient setting, nurses that, and the clinic is just so slow that we were able to enter into a contract with the clinic to use some of the nursing time that they have available. And so we're trying to capitalize on that too. In terms of lab testing, our laboratory has several different platforms that we're using, but we're really down to one platform, and that's the Abbott M2000. That's the only thing that right now that we have reagents to be able to run the testing. Our other CDC-based platforms to do the CDC-based test, we have the reagents to do the PCR. We just don't have the reagents to do the extraction on that end. And so we're sort of dead in the water until we get more extraction reagents for those other platforms. So right now it's the M2000. We have three M2000s that are in the laboratory. Two of them crashed yesterday. And so we're down to one right now. And Dr. Sather sort of mentioned that. And so we apologize up front for the impact on that. But the technician or the technical person from Abbott is in town and will be on site. And so we're hoping that we can get that turned around quickly and get those machines up and operating. We are expecting to receive some additional platforms for PCR testing. There's two ABI 7500s. I don't know what that means. That's what my lab people tell me they ordered. But there's two ABI 7500s that are coming in that should provide some increased throughput. I know we'll have some reagents up front. My concern with any of these platforms is being able to maintain the inventory of reagent we need to continue to do the high throughput. And so it might be a starting point, but in the long run, who knows what happens with that. So, but we continue to diversify our platforms so that we can continue to offer the testing. We are looking at antibody testing as well. I'm not as much interested in some of these point of care tests. There's only one that I'm aware of that has the FDA emergency use agreement approval, Alivia or something like that. But there are a lot of them being marketed. The idea is that if you're buying one of these other kits that are being marketed in the United States, it's up to the local clinic or hospital or facility to do their own validation on those kits. And so, and that's what FDA has specified. So none of them fall under their emergency use agreement. And so my thought is, and my understanding is that we just need to be really, really careful if we're ordering some of these rapid antibody tests and are using them. So we are looking at, there are several different platforms for high throughput antibody testing that we're looking at. None of that we are aware of are FDA approved yet, but we're thinking that FDA approval is going to be coming pretty quick on a couple platforms. So we're looking into that so that we can do some high throughput antibody testing as well. We do have the Architect platform in our laboratory that we use right now for HIV antibodies, hepatitis C antibodies, and a few other things. And so it sounds like that there are some, there will be some reagents for COVID-19 and for that virus on antibodies to that virus on available for that platform. And so we're just waiting to see when those become available on the market. And I'm sure everybody will be after them because the Architect is a rather common platform out there. In terms of
some of the testing that we're doing, we've been prioritizing going into long-term care facilities where we have several staff or several residents who have been undiagnosed. And so that continues to be a priority for us to do that testing and help support that those long-term care facilities and that vulnerable population. We are continuing to encourage clinical testing by all providers, and we feel we have the capacity so that providers don't have, you know, if a person's coming in with respiratory symptoms, they have a couple of symptoms. We don't want somebody just coming in with a little sniffle and being tested, but they have a couple of different symptoms that are suggestive. We certainly are interested in testing. Again, the idea being that we diagnose these people, we can isolate them, we can get them out of the community, get them into their homes, and that we can do the contact tracing around them as rapidly as possible. So there's a lot of things that are making the news, and you saw the pork processing plant down in Sioux Falls with, what are they, close to 300 cases now. We are working with a facility up in Grand Forks that manufactures parts to wind towers, and they have had 9 of their employees that tested positive. The epi on that is not what we wanted to hear. We wanted to hear that this was one nice little group, they're all connected, but actually when we interview them, they don't even know who each other, they didn't even name each other. And so our concern is that we have several different shifts that are involved. We have several different departments that are involved. And so that our concern is that this is wider spread. And so we are doing some testing in that business and amongst those employees, and that will be carried out tomorrow and on Friday, maybe, as depending on what happens there. So I just want to say I appreciate all the work that you're doing on the front lines. You guys are there. You're working with the patients. You're seeing with them. You're caring for them, and we appreciate the work that you're doing. I know that the fruits of your labors come through, and we see them in our Maven Epi surveillance system. And so, when you're doing the testing and it comes into us, we're seeing them. And if you're sending to our lab, you know, we're in this particular situation, we're collecting all the data on the positives and the negatives. So we're doing some epidemiology around all of this, and that's the fun part. I can tell you that when this is all said and done, there will be a ton of data, and there will be lots of opportunities for graduate students to do their research and their theses. So I don't know if I'll be around for that or not, but it'll be exciting. So I'm certainly open for questions, Courtney.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kirby. We're lucky to have you, very much so. The first question we have, and we have some hands raised, so I'll try to get to everybody, but Dr. Schatz asks, nursing homes are asking doctors to stop using nebulized meds on residents who do not have COVID. Inhalers may not work well for frail elderly COPDers. Is this recommendation coming from the health department? I don't know, Joan or Kirby, I don't know who would be able to answer that.
Yeah, this seems more on the medical side. I'm not sure. I know that we're concerned about aerosolizing procedures, but if a patient needs to have a treatment, I think that has to be taken into consideration and the most effective way to get them treated. I'm not sure we would weigh in on too heavily on something like that. I know that our concern is any aerosolizing procedure is going to be a concern, you know, so.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that, but ultimately I think it's, I am hoping it's at the physician's discretion.
Agreed. Joan, did you have a question?
Yes, I had two. Oh, yes, okay. Kirby, that was a wonderful presentation, and you are just the ever-ready bunny, and I'm really impressed. So great job, and thank you for all you're doing. the epidemiologic studies you were talking about with that consortium, I have been hearing from a bunch of different sources about tachypnea actually being a really reliable screening tool. And I'm asking specifically about this because I'm trying to write these guidelines for the intake nurses who are going to be assessing the homeless people. But also, I feel like this is a really useful screening tool for our providers because people don't realize that their oxygen saturations are 70% and the only sign is they're tachypneic. So was that borne out with the epidemiologic group?
You know, it hasn't been, and I think the reason why is what we're getting is what patients are presenting with and what they can verbally communicate, you know, and so they may not know that that's happening to them, and okay. We might get something like rapid heartbeat or something like that, but you know, but it's pretty vague. So
we're
getting those exerts, you know, those symptoms that they can really express: a headache, muscle aches, feverish, or you know, cough. Yeah.
So. Okay. And then my second question is, you were talking about the 14 days for the contact starts on the last day of symptoms. So is that, or the last day the sick one is sick. So for the symptom-based approach, so that's a minimum of 7 days from the onset of symptoms with at least 72 hours fever-free. And, you know, so that's what you're using. Okay.
That's what we're using is for the general public, that minimum of 7 days and 72 hours where no fever and symptoms are improving and no fever reducing meds. So,
okay, thanks.
All right. The next question, Dr. Kumar asked, and I bet you this is for Kirby, what was the most people infected by one positive case?
You know, I don't know if I'm going to get this right because we have had several situations where we've done some follow-up. We had an individual who was teaching a stationary cycling course, and she was doing that while she was symptomatic. And, you know, obviously she's exhaling very hard. We did end up with several cases out of that. And she was mildly symptomatic, obviously, you know, and this was very early on. And so obviously she wasn't all that sick to get on a stationary bike and put yourself up to, you know, that type of heartbeat and respiration level. So we had an Uber driver that that was symptomatic and driving. So there are several different situations where we've had several contacts to cases become symptomatic. I'm not sure if I can, I don't know the data well enough, intrinsically enough to know who that one person was that was the champion at spreading this. So, yeah.
All right, thanks. And then Dr. Kumar has another question. What is the breakdown of state versus private lab? How many total tested by state and how many by private labs? Including the out-of-state labs.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I should have that answer right off the top of my head, and I don't. I can tell you that the majority of what we're seeing is for testing is still coming from the state lab. The out-of-state labs that we are getting, most of our results are coming from Mayo, are the Sanford Sioux Falls lab. So we you know, initially we were getting, I shouldn't say initially, but we did get some results in from Quest, but I think the turnaround time with Quest was pretty lengthy and providers in North Dakota pulled away from using them because the turnaround times were being measured in weeks on those test results. So so most of our stuff is still coming from either Mayo or Sanford and Sioux Falls. So.
All right, thanks. Next question for Kirby. The IHME has continued to revise their model as more data is available. Could you comment on the unique aspects of North Dakota in transmission? Is there any predictive modeling in a mixed area of rural and urban?
So another good question, and another one that's going to make me really sound ignorant. So I haven't been real involved in the modeling. The data that we collect in DC has been going to a modeling group and for their use. I can tell you that some of the things that we've seen, you know, in some of the testing that's been done, for example, the Slope County testing event that went on a week and a half or so ago, and the Gladstone community, you know, a lot of testing, and what we identified, I think, two or three asymptomatic individuals and three symptomatic individuals out of that. So certainly a very low prevalence in those areas. But when you look at it, you know, three cases out of Slope County gave them the highest morbidity rate in the state. You know, they got 800 people. And so, but from our perspective, I think what we're seeing is, in what concerns me a little bit is we're starting to see some vulnerable populations being impacted. We're seeing some long-term care facilities that have had multiple cases now. We're seeing some cases amongst homeless people. And that's concerning because these are populations that are difficult to work with. You know, these long-term care facilities, that's a closed environment and it's a very difficult situation. And so, and I know they're taking it seriously and they're doing a very good job and doing their best, but it's just a very difficult situation once it's introduced into a building. And so, that's concerning. And those are the ones that we're concerned about. The homeless population, because of the behavioral health issues that are often, go along with individuals, substance abuse and other issues, it makes it more difficult. So to find a place where you can put them where they don't pose a threat and spreading it to the rest of the population and being able to do that humanely and that just poses a challenge. And so I think that's another concern of ours at our level. I think that we have a few hot spots, you know, but right now Cass County seems to be our hot spot. And I'm not sure exactly, I haven't been able to put my hand around all of it. I mean, we have a lot of different things going on in Cass County. There's a lot of little clusters that we're sort of in investigating. I talked a little bit. We have a couple of long-term care facilities. We have an assisted living facility that we've in an independent living facility that we've been working with. We have the Uber driver that was in Cass County. We have a couple businesses that we're working with. So there's a lot of these little clusters. We had a church, and maybe to Dr. Kumar's question, is that we had a church, it's a small congregation, less than 50 people, and we had like 10 cases out of that church. They were continuing to meet, and they don't anymore, but yeah, they were continuing to meet. And so we have a lot of these little clusters that are sort of make up what's happening in the community, and it's been sort of an interesting situation, so.
All right. Maybe one more question here from Dr. Govan. Is there any role of quantitative levels of COVID versus just qualitative?
You know, I think there is a role for that. And this is just my thought on this is there's a role because we know so little about this. Dr. Sather was talking about the experiences he has where he has a patient that's tested positive some, you know, weeks down the line and they're still testing positive. Well, we don't understand what that means. Are those viral particles even, are they even infective? Are they even viable? We don't know the answer to that. And so I think there's room for any gaining as much knowledge as we can about this particular virus, because we certainly don't have a very good understanding of what's all happening. So with it and what all the test results we get mean. And even with the antibody tests that are coming out, I think the general consensus is that probably if you have antibody, you were exposed. And if you have antibody, you're probably protected. Are you really protected? We don't have a hard answer to that. We know that you have antibody, detectable antibody, but are those protective antibodies? We don't know, you know, and I know there's a lot of talk, well, we're going to use these antibody tests, and if our healthcare providers have antibodies, we put them on the front line. I'd be hard pressed to make that recommendation, you know, and because until somebody can tell me that antibody test means somebody's really got immunity, you know, we have CDC in North Dakota right now. They came up to provide some technical guidance to us. They sent us a team in. They wanted to come to North Dakota because we're a low morbidity state. They wanted to see what we were doing and then provide some insights and some technical assistance to us. So they're in town, and we asked them about the antibody testing and how do we interpret these. And I think there's just a lot of blanks yet on that. So.
All right, thanks. Dr. Coomer, I wanted to double check that you had your questions. You had your hand raised, and I just wanted to double check.
My question has been answered. Thank you. And I really I'm grateful that Kirby gave us such a good effort. What's going on? Would like appreciate if you could chime in weekly or at least twice a month and give us an update. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's a great idea. I'll be in touch with Kirby. But if there's no other questions, I'd like to say a great big thank you to our panelists. Really appreciate it. And we are going to record this and make it available if people need to watch it later or if people weren't able to make it to the webinar. And I'd like to thank everyone for attending. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.